Galactic Interstellar Council on Revolution Radio Studio A, Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Join us as we traverse the starseed paradigm, as expressed in the time-space continuum that we know as the divine expression of love and light. Integrating this conscious unity into the galactic paradigm. So welcome all, both terrestrial beings and galactic beings as one. So be it. You're listening to Revolution Radio.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Any commercial advertising you may hear in this program is of the sole discretion and benefit of the host of this program you are listening to. Revolution Radio does not endorse any commercial products, nor does it accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at higher risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Well, this is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Raw Deal. I have not one but two guests today with further thoughts about Nashville, which was such a preposterous event that the shooter was wearing black and white Vans sneakers coming in, but then very colorful Puma sneakers when found dead. I mean, it's ridiculous. Do you think he or she changed their sneakers in the middle, brought in an extra pair? It's simply absurd. But I have Alan Burton and Brian Davidson, who has in the past done superb work on Nashville, joining me at the break. Meanwhile, some late developments in the Middle East. Experts doubt the possibility of Arab countries taking military action against Israel. This upsets me profoundly. Coming from TASS, Moscow, November 13th. The Arab countries are likely to toughen their rhetoric regarding the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, but this will not lead to the expansion of armed confrontation in the Middle East, polled experts have told TASS. Audrey Kushkin, the head of the political science department at the Plekhanov Russian Economic University, points out that the escalation of anti-Israeli rhetoric is influenced by pro-Palestinian actions afoot in the Western countries. They are putting pressure on their leaders. They have also seen the joint summit of the League of Arab States and the Organization of Islamic Cooperation in Riyadh, which took place on Saturday. These are very important measures by the world community to contain operations by the Israeli Defense Forces. Washington is also very politically correct in saying yes, we support Israel to some extent, but there's no need to strike peaceful neighborhoods. However, not every country has the ability to get involved in this war. They're trying to steer clear of the conflict. They are trying to contain it. Ain't much likelihood of that since the Israelis are going all out to slaughter every Palestinian in Gaza if they have their way. The summit highlights roots. According to Vladimir Fitton, an advisor to the director of the Russian Institute for Strategic Studies, Saturday's summit of LAS and the Organization of Islamic Cooperation reflected the Arab countries' differing approaches to confronting Israel. these countries adhere to very different views and are led by two different political regimes. There are radical groups like the Yemeni Houthis who are ready to go to war with Israel. In fact, they've already declared war and send their detachments, while others in favor of putting economic cooperation on hold or severing diplomatic relations. This is precisely what was much inside at LAS summit over the weekend. Differing opinions were expressed, while the general support for Palestine was indisputable. I would most certainly like to see more taking place here, but doesn't appear that that's going to happen. Meanwhile, Biden approved Israeli arms deal despite his own security order. The U.S. is supplying the weapons and munitions for Israel pounding of Gaza, despite its new directive barring arms transfer to human rights violators. Remember, too, we're also acting in violation of the Simon Amendment that said that the United States may not provide foreign aid to any nation that has undeclared weapons of mass destruction, in particular undeclared nuclear stockpiles, which, of course, the world knows is true of Israel. So we aren't even following our own laws. 8 months before the Biden admin approved a massive arms deal for Israel amid the war in Gaza, President Joe Biden signed a directive prohibiting such deals for countries likely to use the weapons to attack civilian targets or direct violence against children. Duh. Last week, multiple news organizations reported the Biden admin had approved a $320 million deal for precision-guided bomb equipment for Israel. And Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government continues to bombard civilian targets in Gaza. The Israeli military siege reportedly killed more than 10,000 Palestinians, including more than 4,000 children. The Biden admin's armed transfer decision and its concurrent push for billions of dollars of additional arms sales to Israel came less than a year after Biden issued a formal order to federal agencies forbidding weapon transfer to countries where it's more likely than not that the weapons will be used to engage attacks intentionally directed against civilian objects or civilians or used to commit serious acts of violence against children. What could be more obvious here? Just one more reason for despising the Biden admin. Meanwhile, of course, we know the grim reality of the situation is antiwar.com as well exemplified. Israel is daddy to the U.S. Congress. A revealing letter from my congressman. I wrote a letter to my representative of Congress, William Keating, Democrat, who's a ranking member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. I expressed my opposition to massive Israeli bombing and massive U.S. aid that facilitates that bombing. Yesterday, I received a form letter in reply that reveals Israel remains the daddy to the U.S. Congress. How so? The letter from Mr. Keating is plain spoken and direct in its condemnation of Hamas. There is, however, absolutely no criticism of Israel, none. Hamas is pure evil. Israel is a blameless victim. And that's all you need to know, according to the letter signed by Keating. Some examples from the letter. Hamas is described as launching brutal attacks that bring death and destruction to Israelis and Palestinians. They use Palestinian civilians as pawns and human shields. They are terrorists. It's their attacks that have already taken the lives of too many civilians. The letter also expresses support for a Palestinian state, no other details, for humanitarian aid to Gaza, while mentioning that Israel, in protecting itself against terrorism, must try to protect innocent civilians in Gaza as well. But perhaps the key passage in the letter is this. Israel has the right to protect its citizens against terrorists who continue to attack the country after Hamas carried out the largest massacre of Jewish people since the Holocaust. A ceasefire would only benefit Hamas and allow the terrorist group to rebuild strength and fortify its position. As ranking member on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Mr. King closes his letter by urging Hamas to stop these violent attacks which already taken the lives of 10 many civilians. Nothing about the siege, nothing about protection for occupied people, nothing about the Fourth Geneva Convention, nothing about collective punishment being forbidden. This is absolutely outrageous. Mike King, by the way, has a very nice, relatively short piece about how the oppression took place. I'm going to play it. You won't be able to see it, of course, until you watch the video version, but here it is.
Stop. Did you know?
Alas, of course, there are those commercials. Here we go. RealNewsInHistory.com.
Current developments in the Middle East offer us a good teachable moment for a chronological crash course, 10-point summary of the Israel-Palestine conflict. Know these few key points, and you'll be way ahead of most people when it comes to understanding this seemingly complex, but actually quite simple historical topic. We begin in 70 AD. Having had enough of Jewish intrigue, agitation, and ambush attacks upon their soldiers, the Romans sack Jerusalem and expel the surviving rebellious Babylonian Jews from their homeland province of Judea. The scattered remnants settle throughout the Middle East, Southern Europe, and North Africa. The 700s, Jewish rabbis convert the ruling class of the pagan Khazarian Empire, based mainly in what is today Ukraine and Southwest Russia. The masses of this Near Asian people, today acknowledged as the Ashkenazim supermajority of Jews, soon follows. The mass conversion greatly enhances the ranks of what had been a dying Judaism. These new Jews, along with other North African converts known as Sephardics, will remain true to their religion and people long after the Russian Empire busts up the Khazarian Empire in the 960s. 1000 through the 1800s, throughout the Middle Ages and beyond, the troublesome wandering Khazars and olive-skinned Sephardic Jews are expelled from over 100 kingdoms or nations, including major states such as England, two times, France, Spain, and Portugal, and they are persecuted in many others, Prussia, Russia, Poland, Austria, etc. The usual complaints against them include coin clipping, usurious money lending, undue influence in the affairs of state, disrespect for Christianity, hostility toward their hosts, sacrificial murders of Christian children, and poisoning of wells. The late 1800s, Khazarian Zionists, with no ancestral link whatsoever to the Jews of Roman Empire times, begin a movement to establish a Jewish homeland in Arab-dominated Palestine, which at this time is under the jurisdiction of the Ottoman Turkish Empire. The Zionist movement's nominal leader is Theodor Herzl, but the real bosses are the men of the infamous House of Rothschild. 1890 to 1914, over a period of about 15 years and with the permission of Turkey, the advance guard of European Jewry, totaling no more than 40,000, arrive and settle, mainly as farmers, in Palestine. Neither the Turks nor the local Arabs seem to understand that this low-level Aliyah, as it was called, represents, by design, the camel's nose under the tent. 1917, as the long pre-planned Great War to restructure the world, breaks down into a stalemate, but with Germany, Austria-Hungary, and Turkey holding the advantage, the opportunistic Zionist leaders approach the British with a dirty deal. The scheme, which later took form in the 1917 Balfour Declaration, promises that the Zionists, who own American President Woodrow Wilson, will bring the mighty United States into the war on Britain's side. The price which Britain must pay is to take over Palestine from Turkey after the war and allow the Jews of Europe to migrate there in large numbers in preparation for an eventual Jewish state. Between the World Wars, 1919 and 1939, Jews from Europe flood into British-ruled Palestine over the objections of the Arab majority who now see what the game is. But immigration to Palestine is not enough. The Zionists want a sovereign nation for themselves. Post-World War II years, 1945 to 1948, using the pretext of Jewish suffering during the World War II, the so-called Holocaust, the Zionist desire for an actual nation turns into Zionist demands, backed up by murderous acts of terror against both the British rulers and the Arab locals. Palestine is partitioned by the United Nations in 1947, and Israel is declared as a state in 1948. The United States, the United Kingdom, and the Soviet Union are quick to recognize the new nation. 1948 to 1967, Arab wars against aggressor Israel and domestic uprisings among Palestinians not only failed to dislodge the new American-armed criminal state, but result in Israel acquiring more and more territory, the ultimate goal being a major expansion of Greater Israel into Syria, Iraq, and even Egypt. So complete is Israel's dominance over the Middle East policy of the United States that the 1967 false flag attempted sinking of the USS Liberty, killing 34 U.S. sailors and injuring 171, goes unreported in the U.S. media. 9/11/2001. Though the Zionist faction of international Jewry is often at odds with the global Marxist faction, after 30 years of staging false flag terror incidents designed to ensnare the U.S. in the region, both elements worked together to stage the false flag attacks of 9/11. The purpose of 9/11 was to blame the Muslims and launch endless wars of expansion in both the Middle East and Central Asia. And that, boys and girls, in a nutshell, is the untold story of the Israeli-Palestine conflict, a sad tale of how a quote-unquote desert, which was actually populated by 700,000 Arabs and hardly any Jews at all, has, over the course of just a little more than one century, transitioned from Palestine into the State of Israel, populated mainly by European Khazarians, whose ancestors, incredibly, had never even set foot in the Syria-Palestina of Roman times. And why exactly is this true story an untold story? It's because members of a certain ethnic group have long dominated American media, finance, Hollywood, book publishing, politics, and academia. And that is the story of the Israel-Palestine complex. Be sure to order the book linked below, The Song That Never Ends, The Ultimate Holo-Hoax.
Mike King has done a great job on this. I encourage everyone to pursue it. There's a whole lot elsewhere going on. Here we have Scott Ritter reporting how 80% of the of those who died on the alleged attack by Hamas actually were killed by Israel. Get this.
That's Israel. And the conditions don't exist right now for Israel to use nuclear weapons. That doesn't mean that if the current violence in the Middle East, if it expanded to include an Israeli-Iranian conflict and things went south on the battlefield. The Israeli weapon is not meant to be a preemptive weapon. It's meant to be a weapon of last resort. And the entire notion of deliberate ambiguity regarding Israel's nuclear capacity, where everybody knows it exists, but Israel will not admit it exists, is part of a deliberate plan of that gives Israel a chance to do certain steps before using a nuclear weapon. You know, there is no immediate use of a nuclear weapon by Israel. Israel, phase one of their nuclear postures, you know, ambiguity. Phase two is where they undertake certain covert means of letting people know that there's something here and you don't want to do what you're doing. Phase two can involve public statements made by Israeli officials. For instance, in 2004, we saw Ariel Sharon allude to the existence of a nuclear weapon by Israel. We saw Prime Minister Olmert do the same thing back in 2006. He made a similar allusion. And we can also see actions undertaken by Israel that are designed to send a signal that bad things can happen. In 1991, for instance, Israel sent a signal to Iraq that if they use chemical weapons or biological weapons against Iraq, put them on Scud warheads and fire them, that Israel would respond with a nuclear strike on Baghdad. And to drive that point home, Israel pulled one of its Jericho 2 missiles out and fired it, test fire, using the exact range from the launch site to Baghdad, but they fired it into the Mediterranean. And this was a signal to Iraq that if you use chemical weapons, we'll use a nuclear weapon. But even if you get past phase two and it comes time to use it, what Israel would do then is announce that they have nuclear weapons. Say, we have a nuclear weapon and we're prepared to use it. And if people went, well, we don't believe you, then they'd do an underground test. If people still didn't believe them, they'd do an above ground demonstration. And at that point in time, if people continue to do that, which Israel says you shouldn't be doing, they will use a nuclear weapon against the target. So, the Israeli nuclear weapon is not the trigger for global nuclear annihilation. It's actually a weapon that has a lot of built-in constraints. The threat comes from the American arsenal and the Russian arsenals. This is where the real risk of nuclear conflict has been, is, and will be. This is where we get down to, I said 1 second, less than a second, because all it takes is just one moment of stupidity and it's over.
So
Scott Ritter is so bloody good. You're going to love this. Breaking. IDF discovers who is behind Hamas. You're going to be astonished. From Oons. IDF discovered Hitler is behind Hamas. Palestinian kids are SS officers. Here's the Israeli Defense Forces putting out a tweet. Never again is now. IDF forces discover a copy of Hitler's infamous book, Mein Kampf, translated into Arabic, in a child bedroom used as a Hamas terrorist base in Gaza. The book was discovered among the personal belongings of one of the terrorists, featuring annotations and more. Raise your hand if you're surprised. No hands? It looks like we all saw the situation in Palestine and immediately recognized it as the work of Hitler and his SS organization. Here's from The Guardian. Intense Israeli airstrikes have continued in Gaza after the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu vowed to press Israel's advance into the territory with full force and laid out an uncompromising vision of a post-war settlement. The bombardment on Sunday appeared concentrated around the Al-Sharif Hospital in Gaza City, the largest such facility in Gaza, where much of the most intense fighting between Hamas and Israel ground forces is taking place. The hospital is still full of refugees, by the way, it's just, you can't help but laugh. It's everything I've said about the Jews for a decade, finally on display in front of all humans. The hospital was totally surrounded and bombardments are going on nearby, its director, Mohammed Abu Samai, said in a statement later on Saturday. Here's Sky News breaking. 12 people have died at a Gaza hospital due to electricity running out and dwindling medical supplies, the Palestinian health minister said. Two newborn babies were among the dead, Dr. May Al-Khala, who is not backed by Hamas, said. And there's a whole lot more of this kind of nonsense. Just absolutely unbelievable. Netanyahu blames Arabs, not Hitler, for the Holocaust. An old video of Benjamin Netanyahu has surfaced, in which the Israeli prime minister alleges that Adolf Hitler have not planned the Nazi final solution to exterminate Europe's Jewish population until he was given the suggestion by a Palestinian mufti. He was rightfully raked over the coals for this Nazi whitewashing in an attempt to place blame for the Holocaust on Arabs. Jimmy and his guests, this is on the Jimmy Dore show, Russell Dollar and Keith Weiss from Due Dissident discuss the political angle of Netanyahu's comments. Anyone who wants to know about the Holocaust, by the way, check out my short take, The Holocaust Narrative, Politics, Trump Science, which you can find on the governmentrag.com, for example, or a longer take, The Official World War II Narrative, Fact or Historical Fact or Mass Illusion, which begins with a photograph of the British soccer team at Auschwitz. What? You didn't know there was a British soccer team at Auschwitz? Did you know that the floor plan of Auschwitz included a symphony hall, a woodworking shop, a hospital with OBGY facilities, a brothel? Did you know that hundreds of babies were born in these camps? Hundreds of babies, which according to my understanding still requires 9 months of gestation. So if the Jews were being unloaded from cattle cars, undressed, giving up all their possessions, crowded into these gas chambers, pretending to be mass showers and then extinguished, how could there be any opportunity for sexual relation, much less procreation among the inmates? I mean, it is absurd. Simply absurd. I'll be back with my special guest. Stand by.
Like to take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio.
Hey, everyone. It's Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
join Revolution Radio every Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Well, as virtually every listener of this show is aware, I am pioneering collaborative research on complex and controversial events where I bring together the best expert to sort out what really happened, beginning with JFK, then 9/11, Wellstone, and a series of events, Sandy Hook, Boston bombing, Orlando and Dallas, Charlottesville, Parkland, blowing them apart. The government has not been pleased. And more recently, with Brian Davidson, who's proven to be extraordinarily adept at sorting these things out, we've blown apart Buffalo, Uvalde, Nashville. I mean, some of these are virtually amateurish, where you got to understand, these aren't all professional actors, even though they're being paid, and therefore in a technical sense qualify. They make mistakes. I've mentioned already in Nashville, coming in, the purported shooter is wearing black and white Vans, but when taken out in the close-up, you can see it's colored Puma sneakers as though they stopped and changed their shoes. We had this in a Colorado Walmart. The shooter came in one type of these safari pants and going out a different type, different pockets. I mean, they make these kinds of blunders. Thus, Brian and I have put together a law enforcement false flag stage of it checklist you can download online. Just do a search for it. Alan Burt now has done some additional research on Nashville. He's come up with a number of videos we're going to share. But before we go to Alan, I want to invite Brian to give a kind of an overview about Nashville, what was going on there, and why what Alan has here makes an additional contribution to our understanding of that event. Remember, it was Barack Obama who in 2012 nullified the Smith-Mutt Act that did not permit propaganda being generated by the United States, the CIA, and the Department of State, only for broadcast abroad to be promulgated in the United States. But by nullifying the act by the misnamed Smith Modernization Act in 2012, just in time for Sandy Hook, he opened the floodgate to propaganda. So just as we know Barack put our electoral system under the control of DHS before he left office, claiming it was critical security, so now DHS can monitor the voting and even change it down to the precinct level. We're living with a very dark legacy of Barack Obama. Brian, I'm so delighted you and Alan could join me today. Your thoughts about all of the above? You're muted. You're muted. Yeah.
Sorry about that. I've been studying these false flag events now for a couple of years. It's not like I'm preparing some sort of full paper on, you know, exactly what happened, because the problems that you run into are that your 911 call tape records are different than the video that originates from the scene, which is different than the flight information, which is different than anything that you're seeing. And then later on, some surveillance video comes out from inside the school, such as Uvalde, and that is different as well. Nashville was, in my opinion, a false flag event that was designed to beef up the security apparatus spending related to schools, both public and private, as well as many other things. But I think a lot of people get rich And one of the things that really stuck out to me about Nashville was that it was virtually unreported, except for one little snippet and one little newscast, that there were bombs that were set off at the shooter's house. And it didn't make sense to me for a long time. I was like, how could this possibly be? What does this do? And then after thinking about it for a couple of days, it dawned upon me on why they do that. Because I had seen the bombs at Orlando and the bombs in the Dallas shooting. It's to get security spending related to a larger threat so that these guys can walk, these people that are in charge of getting these laws passed and these bills passed can walk the halls of Congress and say, look, we need all this equipment. We need to do all this stuff to keep the people safe. We need to rebuild the schools, which after Uvalde, very shortly after Uvalde, there was a big initiative to rebuild all the schools with more security features, and in my opinion, to keep parents out, to keep people out of the schools and let the educational system take over. So there's a lot of different facets to why these false flags are run the way that they're run, but I always try to take a look at the most simple and most elegant explanation. I don't necessarily believe it's about having our Second Amendment rights repealed. I don't think that's something that they feel that they can accomplish. I think it's more about just beefing up security apparatus, very similar to after 9/11. What did we get? We got the Patriot Act, the largest security spending apparatus bill that's ever been introduced anywhere at any point in time. And sure enough, they went through it. Look at the changes that happened to the TSA. Look at the changes that happened all over the world as a result of that particular event. So I try to look for the most elegant explanation. And in my opinion, when it all boils down to it, it's that there's a team of people that make a lot of money off of the right stocks and the right companies to buy into and the right security contracts that are put into place. At False Flags and Conspiracies Conference, I'm going to present a presentation on it and basically follow the money.
Well, Brian, I think that's very telling. I've done a review before of the proposals for beefing up the security at these schools. It's absolutely fantastic. All kinds of scanners, all kinds of searches. You go into one compartment, bulletproof glass. It would take, I'd say, an elementary school like Sandy Hook, which at the time ran about $7 million to reconstruct, even though the community was given 50. Seven times $7 million is a partial payoff. These things are enormous scams run by DHS, Homeland Security, Eric Holder, then Attorney General, was orchestrating these and going to different communities and offer them fantastic sums of money. For example, I learned from two of the participants in the event, Margaret Alice Cottle, who was cast as Emily Parker, and Victoria Aurelio, who was cast as Vicky Soto, one a child, the other an adult, who are supposed to have died there. That Eric Holder came in 2006 and offered the community $140 million to participate in this event as a scam on the American people to illustrate what could happen if we didn't take our guns away. Turns out it wasn't even an elementary school. It was actually a special needs school. It was closed in 2006. It doesn't even have a playground. How bad is that? Where members of the community who didn't want to participate just moved out of Sandy Hook, moved out of Newtown, and the whole event went forward. All kinds of benefits. They signed non-disclosure agreements. They have auditions for roles. They don't have to pay taxes. They get free college tuition. I mean, it's just a monstrous scam, and you and I, the American taxpayer, are paying for it. Now, false flags, of course, are a worldwide phenomenon. We've had one now in Gaza with this attack on October 7th. That's very elaborate. Hitler pulled off a similar stunt at the Polish border early on, in part of precipitating World War II. And now, of course, the Israelis are trying to draw American in by attacking American bases in Syria and blaming it on Iran, because they'd like nothing more than for the United States to attack Iran, which is their foremost enemy in the Middle East, the major obstacle to Israel dominating the entire region. So false flags are no trivial matter. What is novel in the American experience is having so many take place right here in the United States, where I say Barack Obama is the godfather of false flag operations here in America. Alan, I'm so pleased you could join us today. Give us a little about your background, how you got drawn into this, and how you became fascinated by Nashville.
Well, I came here today to speak about Uvalde. It started for me about 3 years ago. This was after the election. And after the election, I began to ask questions I should have asked sooner in my life. And I started with 9/11. And after processing the horror of that, I then began to look at other things that I'd heard of. You know, the school shootings, even after 9/11, I thought that was, you know, those being false flags, I thought that was ridiculous. And it took me a while before I could find the appropriate information, much of which includes the work that you've done. And after I saw it, I came away thinking, how could anybody believe this nonsense? So I feel it incumbent upon myself to try to convince other people about these the false flag events.
Of course, as Brian has implied, the government has vast resources. If they need some additional evidence, they can fabricate it. They did it at Orlando. They made up a videotape that's completely ridiculous that I've critiqued elsewhere. They have had Amazon ban 6 of my books about Sandy Hook, Boston bombing, Orlando and Dallas, Charlottesville, Parkland, and even the moon landing, though that appears because of a section devoted to essays about the Holocaust, where it turns out that, according to the International Committee of the Red Cross, who's keeping copious detailed notes about the age, the sex, the ethnicity, the religion, and cause of death of all the inmates, in 1993 recalibrated the number and found a total of 296 and 81 had died from all causes combined, none of whom had died from being put in a gas chamber. It's just outrageous. But then the Israelis want to play it up, that victimhood card, because it's been a source of their political influence since World War II, namely a Western sense of guilt over the Holocaust. One of the effects we're seeing now with this mass slaughter of Palestinians is they're losing that status. On October 7th, they lost that aura of invincibility that the IDF was in complete control. They can never regain that. It had taken a massive hit earlier in a war in Lebanon when Hezbollah had basically defeated the fourth most powerful army in the world. And therefore, of course, great animosity and fear by Israel that Hezbollah might become involved. But more recently, with a slaughter of Palestinians, the all-out assault, the genocide, the moral stature of Israel has been shattered forever, no doubt about it. The ramifications are going to be enormous. But the government has all sorts of resources it can bring into play. Now, Alan, I know you have a series of videos that I've made you host so you can play them. I believe the very first has to do with Nashville. Would you like to tell us what you got and where you want to begin?
Okay, so again, this will be about the Uvalde event, right? So for your listeners, it's not going to be a stunning revelation that the Uvalde event was a hoax. You know, in my opinion, I think it was the sloppiest one that they've done yet. However, if we can't convince the public that this one was a contrived event, I think we're in big trouble.
Well, Alan, just for, I thought your very first video, I mean, I started playing, it was Nashville coming. Was that not Nashville? Is that actually Uvalde too?
The videos that I sent were for Uvalde.
They're all Uvalde. All right, so let me correct my mistaken impression. We're going to be focusing on Uvalde, which is, by the way, let me say, by way of background, was modeled after Sandy Hook. Now, at Sandy Hook, you have this purported shooter, Adam Lanza, who kills his mother with a .22 caliber rifle, then goes to the school and shoots up 20 first-grade kids and 6 adults. What we have in Uvalde, they varied the case. Now, he shoots his grandmother, and he goes to school and shoots up 19 second, third, and fourth graders. I mean, how ridiculous can you get? Alan, pick it up from there.
Okay. All right. So we could spend days, you know, going over all the lies, inconsistencies, all the irregularities. But I think we need to be able, to communicate the fraud to normies, okay, by focusing on details that require a minimum degree of interpretation or speculations or ones that permit little wiggle room. So to my dismay, I found that many people, they're not persuaded by, you know, strange or unnatural behaviors of the crisis actors, and they're inclined to make excuses for them. So it's very, you know, it's very frustrating. So I think what we have here is we have evidence that both the audio and the video of the hallway footage from the day of the Uvalde event were manipulated. And they were manipulated and doctored in such a way as to deceive. And I believe that even the most creative apologist will have difficulty finding an innocent explanation for this manipulation. So before we go over the details, I'd like to view the footage from the point where Ramos, the putative shooter, walks to and enters the school building and then walks down one of the corridors to classrooms 111 and 112, where the 21 victims were supposedly massacred. And so this comes from the 1 hour, 22 minute video that was released by the Austin American Statesman and KVU-12. So this will be the video that sets the stage for the others that we'll examine. Okay, can you see the video?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, so before we move on, there's something I want to make a comment on here. If you look on the right-hand side, this is camera footage that was taken from a house across the street, Geraldine Street. And this is something that Brian has spoken about in previous programs. Now, if you look at this video footage, you'll see that there is a corrugated roof. It kind of gives an optical illusion that this pole and the sign are rising kind of out of the street. What's interesting is that there are two separate pieces of footage that were in the media. And one of them had this corrugated roof, and the other did not. And they're pretty much from the same, almost the same light of sight. So I think that the other set of footage was probably taken from a more forward part of the house. So it's already unusual that you would have, you know, one person in a house who just happens to capture with his or her video phone the shooter entering the school. But here you actually have two separate people within the same house. And that speaks to a high degree of coordination. Okay, so I'm going to continue now. Okay, so the precise time at which he enters the school is, it's 11:33.
That's impossible according to the call sheet.
Yeah. Okay, so what's interesting here, and I'll rewind it again so that you can see it, is that as he enters the hallway, before he even gets to the intersection of the corridor, you see the camera beginning to rotate 90 degrees. So the camera is already anticipating his motion. Okay, and then right on cue, once the camera has fully rotated 90 degrees, a little boy pops out of the restroom.
Alan, it says the sound of children screaming has been removed, but how could they do it? It would be concurrent with a shot. I mean, that would be very tricky. Yeah,
exactly. That's an excellent point. So you would have to believe that somehow there was this staccato type rhythm of children screaming that, you know, when the shots were being fired, that that the children would just suddenly stop screaming. That makes no sense. Okay, so I'm going to rewind it again because I just want to make sure everyone gets to see this.
By the way, they don't claim there were sensors on the camera, so it would automatically pan to follow anyone. I mean, this had to be done by human manipulation.
Yeah, that's correct. And there's other video footage that I can point to that proves that. Obviously, when the officers arrived, the camera doesn't respond to their motion. And there was another teacher who they showed video footage of her. This was the teacher that supposedly left the door propped open. But when she goes into the same corridor that he's about to walk into minutes earlier, the camera doesn't respond to her motion. Okay, and another thing, the little boy, to me, it seems like when he comes out of the restroom, it looks like he's already anticipating seeing someone, even though he hasn't seen the shooter as of yet until he turns the corner.
Are we expected to believe children aren't screaming as the gunshots are fired, or that the FBI selectively removed the screams overlapping the gunshots? Come on, Alan.
Exactly. Okay, so that sets the stage. Now, there's a lot to unpack in this footage, and I want to summarize this. Let me bring up the next video first. Okay. The camera footage inside the school begins at exactly 11:33, even though the original time provided in the media was 11:40. It's set at 11:33 to a fraction of a second. I slowed the footage to the last frame of the view switches to the inside of the school, and it was 11:33.00. And you know, of course, we know that these numbers, 11 and 33, they have special numerological and Masonic meaning, and they frequently use those numbers in their signaling. Now, usually I don't tend to emphasize these kinds of aspects, but this one was so so blatant and so over the top that it's definitely worth mentioning here. Now, you see the shooter, he casually passes by three of the classrooms near this west side entrance without even inspecting them to see who's inside. So he already knew which room he was going to. And the classrooms that he shoots into, they're conveniently positioned far enough away from the camera to prevent a clear view of the classroom doors. But it's the camera motion and or the setting itself that are, you know, huge red flags. The starting position of the camera is focused on the side entrance such that there's only about, you know, 30 to 45 feet of coverage within the school. And recall that this is a door that was expected to be locked. So this is an unusual default position for the camera. Now, once the shooter enters the school, the camera angle begins rotating before the shooter has even entered the intersection. So, you know, who's controlling the camera? You know, in the movie, you're supposed to ignore the presence of the cameraman, but obviously there's someone behind the camera here. And so these types of cameras, they're either manually controlled or they operate on a program schedule. They're not motion sensitive. And you can see that the camera precisely anticipates the path of the shooter as he turns down the corridor. And none of the reports that I read did I see any mention of anybody looking at the shooter behind the camera. Now, once the camera rotates a full 90 degrees, right on cue, the little boy pops out of the restroom. Clearly, no one looks for him when the school goes on lockdown. And this is even after the teacher, Amelia Marin, she was the one who made the phone call, and she was also the one who supposedly had left the door propped open, and then they decided, no, that she hadn't left the door propped open. But just minutes earlier, she had been in the hallway yelling at the kids to get in their room. And they actually provided video footage of her doing that on ABC. So during that footage, when she goes into the corner, I'm sorry, she goes to the intersection of the corridor, the camera does not follow her motion. It doesn't rotate. Now, once that camera has rotated that full 90 degrees, it stays fixed in that position for the remainder of that time, which is approximately 1 hour and 15 minutes. Again, we've already gone over the screams, no screams overlapping the gunfire. I think probably the most important point here, though, is that the shooter, he never goes down the hallway, goes down the hallway beyond classrooms 111 and 112. So once he turns left, goes into and presumably shoots into those classrooms, he never comes out again. Now, this is important because there were many stories from children in other classrooms who claimed to have seen the shooter and to have seen him shoot into their respective classroom. And of course, the only classrooms that he went into were 112 and 111. There was even one media account where it said that he shot into the classroom and left shells on the floor of the classroom. So these media accounts had a high degree of specificity in them. Okay, so, all right, so now that we set the stage, we can move on to the next video. And this is where I believe we see evidence of the tampering of hallway audio.
Oh, you got to stand by, Alan. Stand by. We'll be right back. This is after this break with Alan Burton and Brian Davidson taking a closer look at Uvalde. Right back. About a 5 minute break.
Listen to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com and we'll be right back after this message.
I would just leave it there. It's okay. So, gotta go check the mail for you.
Was it a conspiracy? Did you know that the police in Boston were broadcasting, "This is a drill, this is a drill," on bullhorns during the marathon? That the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities? And that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of the library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs. But there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio-quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out And Nobody Died in Boston Either. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
That the Capitol will ever treat us fairly. You are lying to yourselves. Because we know who they are and what they do. This is what they do, and we must fight back. You can torture us and bomb us. Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet? I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. The time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence. At the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Not giving up.
Revolution Radio. It is no secret that the so-called mainstream media is best described as controlled propaganda. Countless news stories are either totally ignored or spun with half-truths, and because of this, essential facts and vital information are often compromised. Join Dr. Ott every Friday night on Studio B at 10 p.m. Eastern and learn why The Story Behind the Story was nominated for a Peabody Award in its second year of producing unparalleled broadcasting excellence in 1997. That is, if you really care about learning the truth.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. This is Revolution.Radio. Don't forget to go over to the Revolution.Radio archives. Your guest is muted. Whoever's on the top is trying to talk. He's muted. Can't hear him. Unless Jim has to unmute him, I'm not sure. Jim's all missing in action. I guess he's coming back here any second. But yeah, Revolution Radio is listener supported. There's Jim. Jim, your guest's muted. We can't hear him.
The first 911 call that the male subject was inside the school happens at 11:34. No, earlier than that. 11:32:07, 911 received a call that the subject was inside the school. And so they start their timelines at 11:33, leaving out almost a whole minute. Now, it takes a few seconds for somebody to call 911 and advise that they're inside the school. You're supposed to have 911 calls that are originating from within the classrooms, according to media reports. They don't happen. Not on the 911 call sheet for Uvalde Police Department.
Yep.
You've got a woman that was supposedly shot in the head on Diaz Street at 11:35. That's the first report of a woman shot in the head. 11:37, the female inside the school is locked in a closet and advising somebody's banging on the door. We don't see anybody banging on any doors. 11:38, they're still reporting the shootout happened at the funeral home. And 11:38, you've got the male subject inside the building is contained. So they're saying that by 11:38, 8 minutes into it, they had the situation contained. And then we have other reports that there's all these calls originating from kids who smeared themselves in blood from within the classroom, 111 and 112. They're covered in blood and they're hiding under dead bodies. You know, this is that ridiculous stuff, and they're talking in a whisper.
Excellent, Brian. That's just what I wanted. Had I not been delayed rejoining you, your comments on it, I'd add they actually recycled crisis actors from Sandy Hook. Vicky Aurelio, for example, cast as Vicky Soto, the dead heroic teacher at Sandy Hook, was cast as Eva Morales, another dead teacher in Uvalde, for which she was paid $210,000. I mean, that's your money and mine. The situation is just as absurd as it gets. Alan, go ahead.
Okay, so here we go. So let me share the screen again.
I'll send it, Don. I'm on the air. Go ahead.
Okay, so we want to look at the top of the screen. And we'll show a close-up of this. But the sound that the gunshot makes precedes the elevation of the rifle.
Yeah, this whole thing is a fraud. Nothing makes sense.
Okay, so then the next point. Let's fast forward. Okay, so here, this is the key point. So we want to.
Now, coming off in there, I mean, this whole thing sounds like 40 beheaded babies.
It does, Brian, but people will still believe it. It's remarkable. Okay, so just to make sure that there is no issue with the synchronization altogether, if you look at other parts of this video, you can see where there are sounds that are made that are synchronized with the motion or the effect that's supposed to produce them. So I won't go over that in much detail. So the next, here's the next video. Okay. So in the upper left-hand corner, this is where the shooter entered, the west entrance. He then takes a right-hand turn, goes down this corridor. And area of interest is within this box. 111 and 112, of course, are the classrooms that the shooter went into, or is supposed to have gone into. All right, so within this box, you see these fire barrier doors. And by the way, this is from the floor plan, from the report that was done by the House of Representatives in the Texas House of Representatives. Okay, so anyway.
Remember, there were also interested parties in these surrounding rooms because there were bullets that went through the walls and hit people. Yeah. So.
Yep.
Okay.
So on this left-hand side, this is where you see the janitor closet. And this is the door that we were just looking at a while ago. And so this is the door where presumably a bullet came out of. This janitor closet, it has no access to room 112. So the question is, you know, how could possibly a shot have come out of that room or that janitor's closet? So here's body cam footage of Officer Mendoza. Okay, there's the door. You see that the door, there's, you know, it's clean, no holes in it. There's no bullet holes in the surrounding wall. Okay.
I want to point one other thing out that I noticed when I was on campus. When I was on campus like 2 days later, and of course they wouldn't let me get on the campus. These particular rooms, 111 and 112, have absolutely no line of sight from any point around the perimeter of the school. They're the only rooms that have absolutely no... I walked the entire perimeter that I was allowed to walk. You cannot get eyes, get a zoom camera in there. You can't get anything into this particular area. So they selected the only place on campus that was completely locked out from visibility once the perimeter was set up.
Yeah, that's a good point. Okay. So here, I'm going to show an exchange between Officer Mendoza and Gasway. Gasway is an interesting character. He's the game warden there. And he shows up in Crocs and shorts. And throughout the time that he's there, he's carrying around this orange booklet. It's about 15 or 20 pages, it looks like, that are in it. I don't know. It looks to me like it could be a script because he appears to be coordinating the actions of the other officers. But I think it's kind of strange for a game warden. All right, so you see Mendoza point to a bullet hole that's supposedly on the right wall. And Gasway makes this kind of, you know, quizzical, comical look on his face. All right, so Mendoza responds that it's the janitor's room. So, and then he also points to a phantom bullet hole on the opposite side. And so I think this is why they messed up so badly. Because they, I think that's part of the script. They wanted to put in a bullet shot that corresponded to that bullet hole in the wall. That's the only thing I can think of that makes any sense. Here it is again. Okay. And so if we look at the footage on the right hand side.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so we don't see any bullet holes, and so unless the man or the officer with the gas mask on his head is blocking the bullet hole, there is no bullet hole. But if there was a bullet hole there, it begs the question, why would somebody stand there for 15 minutes in front of a hole that was made by a bullet? Okay, so now what I want to do is I want to back up to the scene where the first responding officers take positions outside of 112 and 111, and then they're fired upon. We're going to focus on Officer Canales. He sets up on the right side of the hallway, right there. Notice that it's the left side of his head that faces the opposite wall.
Now, where's the timestamp? Did they take that off?
Yeah, so I took that up just so that you could see a close up of it, but I could give you the timestamp. This is somewhere between 11:33 and 11:37.
Wow, yeah, what a response. I mean, you got 19 officers on site very early.
Okay, so there you see him. He reaches for the right side of his head. So instinctively, he reaches for the side of his head that's closest to that wall at the time, which is the right side, but that wasn't the side when the gunshots were fired. Okay, so how are we doing on time?
Fine, just fine. I killed the break. Just go.
Okay. All right, so the last set of footage that I want to show is that for the Angelie Rose Gomez story.
It could have been the last one, and it was for many of the parents who lost their children who had been there. Like many parents, after that, she left, she went back to work, back to the field. And within 10 minutes, she received a frantic call from her mom telling her that there was a shooting at the school. So she got in her car, and she sped at about 100 miles an hour, she told me, until she finally got here. And this is what she told me after.
Right away, as I parked, U.S. Marshal started coming toward my car saying that I wasn't allowed to be parked there. And he said, well, we're going to have to arrest you because you're being very uncooperative. I said, well, you're going to have to arrest me because I'm going in there. And I'm telling you right now, I don't see none of y'all in there. Y'all are standing with snipers and y'all are far away. If y'all don't go in there, I'm going in there. Brett immediately put me in cuffs.
She says after Uvalde police officers told marshals to uncuff Gomez, she ran towards the school.
As soon as they uncuffed me, I jumped that first gate fence. And once I jumped it, I went to my son's class. And I knocked on the door, and I remember the teacher saying, I'm like, hey, they're already bolt cutting the fence to get me. She's like, you think we have time to get out? time I'm going to run for my other son.
Once she was assured her son was okay, Gomez ran to get her other child, encountering more officers who tried to stop her.
So I start yelling and I'm being cooperative and I'm like, well, y'all aren't doing what are y'all doing? Y'all ain't doing y'all need a beer here. Give me your vest. Somebody give me a vest. Something. I started paying attention to how far the shots were being. So that I knew the shooter was all the way still by my first son's class. So when I went to my second son's door, the teacher didn't want to open the door for me. So that's when they started escorting me out. And as I see that they're opening my son's door, I go run for my son and I get him.
With both of her kids out safe, Gomez still can't shake the thought of those who didn't make it.
While you were inside the school, did you see officers there inside was not the one school? Officer inside the school when I ran to my second son's class. There was not one officer. And you were hearing gunshots, so you knew you could hear the gunshots. It was still active. The gunshots were still active. They were not in there. There was no one in there. If anything, when I pulled up, my car was closer to the school than where the snipers and everybody that was laying on the...
Okay, so now we're going to see what really happened with her.
Yeah.
And this comes from the following footage you'll see is from the cell phone camera of Angel Ledesma, who is an associate of Ms. Gomez. And this was the footage that was used by CBS.
It was, you know, what's funny about this footage before you go into it, I'll just throw you some things. Okay, first of all, this Facebook account had never, ever live streamed and barely had any posts on it whatsoever. I mean, when you see a scammer, you think, okay, they got no history, they got no friends, they got no connections. This was a very, very new Facebook account that had very few connections, and he had never, ever live streamed. So you're telling me that this guy arrives at the school with his wife and immediately begins to live stream and live streams for over 50 minutes. I have the entire video. I've analyzed all of it. I've used it for earliest and most reliable footage. And to me, one of the most spectacular things about the footage is that he does capture a lot of the activity that happens outside the school. But most importantly, the first ambulance, and only one ambulance, arrives at 12:44. 12:44. One ambulance, one cot rolled out at 12:44. There's no EMS response whatsoever. And according to the 911 reports, we've got them sending buses to pick up the kids and take them home before any of this takes place. None of this makes any sense. None of it. And you try to reconcile the earliest, most reliable evidence with the 911 tapes. It's impossible.
Excellent. Just excellent, okay. Brian. Excellent.
All right, thanks, Brian.
Thank you for trying to decide.
Okay, so Ms. Gomez makes her appearance behind this black vehicle up in this upper right-hand corner.
By the way, let me point something out. Ledesma's shooting from less than 50 yards across from the school the whole time. Never once do you hear a gunshot of any sort during the entire Ledesma video. And remember, he arrives at 11:41 approximately. So approximately 15 minutes into it, he arrives. You don't hear any gunshots whatsoever, yet they say that the shooter expended over 150 rounds at the school. None of it happens on Ledesma. You see a very weak police presence around the east side of the building where the police are. Just nothing adds up. Doesn't add up. So what makes sense is that it's just a drill, and these are photographers. They haven't got photographers in place to get the screaming kids jumping out the windows. That's what you see in the background there. And then you'll see Gomez come running out with these couple of kids. She becomes the big hero with the big story. Lots of camera time for her.
Yeah. So then she then goes to the next pickup point. And here's a close-up. before she gets to the pickup point. Never goes into the school. It's never handcuffed or obstructed by police officers.
This is not an emergency. If you watch the Ledesma video, the narration is the only thing that convinces you that there's something serious happening. Other than that, if you just look at the visible evidence, it's ridiculous. Right. And I can tell you for certain, being on the scene less than 2 days later, interviewing different kids rolling around the school, is that they're absolutely planted there. One of the three or four kids that would be rolling around would tell the story. The other three would step back. Parent was behind, the parent or guardian or whatever was behind them. Nothing added up about any of this because there was only one kid designated speaker that was either in the school or not in the school or had the day off. And they're floating around there talking to different media agencies with the same canned stories. So this is how they deceive the media into following this up, is that they send people into the area. Now, also, let me point this out. Supposedly, if you were to go down and park your car, if you get the online security app.
Hey, I apologize. I thought I killed a break, but I hear it maybe. Okay, keep going. I guess now Mitchell has a dip. Go ahead.
I'm going to take the air out of your tires with this. This is also familiar to me.
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead, Alan. I'm sorry I interrupted.
Oh, I'm sorry. So, again, this is the next pickup point. Again, she's picking up the next child. And there you see it. She grabs the child from you know, children being walked out. You see the teacher there. Actually, even gives a nice little wave. Now, the most incredible aspect of the story is that afterwards, she decided to get a lawyer to try to sue the town and the police. And so it's absolutely inconceivable that, first of all, that she could have done all this without, obviously, foreknowledge, and also without an expectation that she would not be arrested by the authorities for the false claims she made against them. And of course, one of the biggest liars here is CBS. I mean, they have this original footage. This is what they used for their story.
That field that you're seeing in the background, remember that your AP photographers were stationed in that field looking out that direction, watching the kids jump out the window when they finally released the kids to let them all come out in this flurry. And why would an AP photographer be placed back in that field with a zoom lens watching the kids jump out the window? So staged.
You guys are just a terrific combination. I just love all of this. Alan is just terrific, what you picked up. And Brian, I just love you know this thing in such detail. So even this woman who heroically rushes in, that was all scripted. I wonder how much she was paid off. I love these lawsuits. They're participating in a scam. It's all laid out, yet they want to bring lawsuits in addition. You know, I mean, it's just ridiculous. Brian, your thoughts.
Well, Ledesma was driving a rental car with temporary plates, so he wasn't even in his own car. So he couldn't get any plates off anything that he shot that would be of any use. You don't see the police presence that you would expect. It's more being operated like it's a drill with police just keeping people away from the school. They bring the kids out at a particular point in time, holding the hand of a particular adult, and then they release them, but it's the wrong side. The buses are positioned on the other side, where supposedly the emergency response is supposed to be. You have all sorts of problems with the 911 police call sheet that come out. You've got dead bodies strewn all over on the other side of the school where the funeral is at, but you've got no indication whatsoever of anything being roped up or any type of scene taking place. Remember, Ledesma was supposed to be coming straight down the street when he arrived, you know, with all these guns and all these things. He had already killed his family. And remember, less than 2 hours after this shooting, they announced that Ledesma had acted alone. And this is theoretically based on a 911 call that came from one of his cousins stating that he had killed his mother or his grandmother.
Yeah, grandmother. Yeah.
You know, how do you know if you've conducted an investigation that you've got case closed, he acted alone? At the very first press conference that originates after this, it all stinks of absolutely no investigation, case closed, let's close this up. And then you've got the Texas Department of Public Safety and the Texas Rangers coming down to give the event credibility for their press conferences. They have no answers in terms of how things went down, what went down, who got killed, when, where, why, and how. And they just simply gaslight all away with this, with their uniforms. And it's quite a show. You go and show up and you're like, hey, I'm at the most surreal circus you've ever seen in your life, and the way that they rope this thing off. What kind of investigation results, just straight up, what kind of investigation results in knowing that the shooter acted alone less than 2 hours afterwards, when he's got $5,000 to $7,000 worth of equipment and supposedly killed all these different people, not only inside the school, but outside the school with his semi-automatic weapon? Who happened to be in position to grab the photos of them, of him entering? Who happened to be in position to get all these photographs? This thing stinks to high heaven. I mean, it just does.
I think Eric Holder's getting sloppy to let it go down this way. I mean, I have no doubt he's still running these ops behind the scene through FEMA. You know, it's FEMA that orchestrates these mass shootings, and they give the communities massive sums of money. You already heard they're rebuilding all those schools in Uvalde. And, of course, we had the little girl who had two different fathers on different networks. I mean, how ridiculous was that? Brian, you want to comment?
Well, what really shocked me about it is that when I approached one of the entrances, they asked if I was there to pick up my car. And so I asked them questions, and they said, yeah, you got to scan your Homeland Security app so that you can pick up your car from the parking lot and get paid.
And get paid. Okay. And get paid. And get paid, Brian. God damn. It is so blatant. It is so blatant. Alan, I know you must have more you want to add. Even another video clip is yours.
No, that's fine. Yeah, so if you go through and you look at all of the media reports having to do with the children and or their direct relatives, there were at least 13 separate narratives from the children or the relatives that are just verifiably false on substantive details. And usually it involved, you know, whether or not the shooter appeared at a given classroom, or even if the shooter was even in the same building. There is an abundance of grossly photoshopped images of the victims and their family members. And there are so many of them. Some are so bad that a child is able to point out the problems. You had two of the victims, Jackie Cosaris and Navaya Bravo, that are in the class pictures for both classrooms 111 and 112. I don't know about you guys, but when I went to the class picture just in one class.
Oh, God. Go on.
Okay. But the funny thing is that they didn't even bother to include the name of Navaya in one of them, as if she didn't belong. And yet, Mia Cerillo, who turned 12 in November of 2022, and therefore would have been expected to be at least in the fifth grade, she's in either photo, and her name is not included at the bottom of either picture. Something Brian brought up before in the previous program is that, you know, ignoring the fact that Chloe Torres is also absent from both photos, you know, why did she say a blonde man shot at her? Why in the world would there be two photos in the obituary film of Navaya Bravo that have date stamps of 1998? And I guess we're supposed to ignore the fact that she looks just like her mother, and that her mother was 11 years of age in 1998. You have Samuel Salinas. He mentions a Miguel being in classroom 112 at the time of the event. There was no Miguel, first or middle name, in either class. And by the way, I speculate that Samuel is the child who came out of the laboratory in the hallway footage. The striking resemblance between them. He has kind of an unusual posture that matches the kid who comes out. And you would think of all the children that were involved that day, that would be the child that they want to write the story about, you know, all the drama. But yet there's no story for them, no name. Then you have Kim Rubio, the mother of Lexi Rubio. She's now running for mayor of Uvalde. She provided a narrative before Congress that simply could not be true. And this was before this hallway footage was released to the public. She had said it was her her husband's rare day off. He was a deputy sheriff. Never mentions the fact that he was one of the responding officers who can be seen in the hallway footage. And she said that both had run a mile to the school together that day because they didn't have a vehicle at the time, which just on the surface of it sounds ridiculous. And the timeline she provides is simply not consistent with his appearance at the school in Uvalde in the video footage. So it goes on and on, you know, as Brian has said. The Uvalde narrative, you know, just on its surface, it strains credulity. But if you factor in, you know, all these lies, inconsistencies, and fabrications, it's mind-boggling that anybody would not harbor at least, you know, some suspicion that this was a contrived event. But what's very frightening is that, you know, a lot of people still insist on believing that this was a true event.
Yeah, this, you guys are just doing super. Brian, more thoughts of yours. You've done this so thoroughly, too. Alan, I got to congratulate you. This is just first-class stuff. I really like it. Brian.
Well, I have very big files on all this, but, you know, I want to point out something that we saw very clearly in this particular shooting that is your big, big red flag. And if anybody knows what Ollie Damagard says, he's been tracking shoes related to these events, the presence of shoes being photographed. We certainly had that with Matthew McConaughey's green Converse playing a very central role in the after media that came in. You know, you've always got some green shoes. I also want to remind you that there was a Facebook account called Uvalde Bargain Deals that continued to post on this. And, of course, they had the officer that was a BORTAC officer that went in to have a shootout with the police officer. And he, of course, had a picture of his hat, which had a hole in it and some stitches on the top of his head. You've got all sorts of early evidence that originated from the scene that doesn't make any sense in terms of how this thing all went down. I collected massive amounts of files on this particular event, and I can tell you something. I simply don't buy it. I don't buy any of it.
Brian?
Yep.
Yeah, by the way, that officer that you mentioned, that BORTAC officer, he never shows up. You don't see him in the hallway footage. You don't see him in the body cam footage of any of the officers. I looked up and down to see if I could find that guy. He's not there.
Yeah. And remember that the GoFundMe accounts went absolutely berserk after this. Everybody made a lot of money. Even dead people made a lot of money. Made a lot of money from this just because of the public outcry and whatever accounts that they used to load these GoFundMe accounts up with money. Everybody got rich. Lots and lots. And the school, you know, got demolished shortly thereafter. Doesn't exist. Huge funding to get new things going. But one of the things that really stood out to me was the presence of vehicles with Masonic symbols on them. And the house, from the first video that you shot, where somebody was shooting from the roof of the house of the shooter entering the school, which that video was given to CNN. Right on the front of the house in the street view was a large Masonic. It was almost a 2-foot by 8-foot compass indicating that the house was a Masonic place. And then lots of vehicles at the surrounding houses had Masonic stickers on them as well. They had locked down all the houses when I toured it and tried to get interviews. People wouldn't talk. Some people were obviously designated to talk as spokesmen, but other people just simply wouldn't come to their door. So it was very difficult to collect this information. And the idea that the shooter loaded up, he had over 30 magazines in the truck, had whatever he had on him, shot at the funeral home, people coming out to see what the rush was, shot at the school, entered the school. None of the early reports make any sense in terms of these shots. I mean, just, again, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of shots, survivors that cover themselves with blood. The whole thing is just too much for me to swallow. I'm not buying it.
Man, oh man, I mean, it's just a monster F up, unreal. It's so badly done. The original amateur hour. Alan, further reflections of yours.
Yeah, I wanted to also, when Brian mentioned the footage that was taken from the house, the one with the corrugated roof, if you slow that footage down enough, in the initial frames, you actually catch there are two pairs of legs that are caught in the footage, and they're standing there right in the street, right in view of where Ramos had entered the school. And so that's, you know, very odd, of course, you know, the idea that, you know, either they were the funeral home workers who decided to continue to run over to the other side of the funeral home just to watch and go in. That doesn't make a lot of sense. And the idea that it could have been two police officers who just stood there watching them going in without going, that doesn't make a lot of sense either. So, Brian's right that clearly that house functioned as a sort of monitoring station. And so you've got two people inside the house, on top of the house taking camera footage. And then you've got two pairs of legs that are caught in the camera footage directly outside. I think one of the,
on the Ledesma video, there's no sirens. You'll never hear a siren.
Yeah. You never hear any sirens in the body cam footage either. You have responding officers who are outside at times where you should have heard sirens or you should have heard gunshots. And you never hear them.
Incredibly calm scenes. Like, hey, yes, let's get this drill over with.
Let me just add, I love the product placement. You know, you got one parent who claims her child could only be identified by the green Converse sneakers she was wearing. Then they show green Converse sneakers that just came out of a box. They've not even been untied. And then you have Matthew McConaughey come down with his wife, and guess what? She's wearing green Converse sneakers. This is so insulting.
There was also a report of a man confronting the shooter outside the school. This is one of the funeral house workers. Plus, you had a pastor that supposedly was at the funeral home that was killed. There was no indication of anything being roped off in the early Ledesma video. You have a woman shot in the head on Diaz Street. You've got the parent shot in the head at the home of the shooter. You got the cousin calling 911 to say he acted alone. I mean, come on, guys. You're going to have to do better. And, you know, Nashville went bad. And remember that the big outcry among the normies on Uvalde was that it took so long for these professional police agencies to enter this room and dismantle the shooter. He was in the room, supposedly locked, barricaded in the closet for over an hour while the struggling kids bled out and died and called 911. And so there was the big, hey, the police didn't respond. They were afraid to go in, the whole thing. So Nashville, when it was finally executed, different setting, different type of thing. But they had the police operating like a well-oiled machine, zooming on in there to get the shooter super fast. And the big problem that I had with Nashville wasn't the shoots. The big thing that I had with Nashville was the lack of recoil on the rifle that was supposedly used to take the shooter out at the first point in time. I compared real recoil versus what we saw in that. And that police officer that supposedly took out the Covenant School shooter released four rounds in one, I think it was four or six rounds in 1.07 seconds without any recoil, with perfect accuracy and no holes in the wall at approximately 15 yards. So, hey, whatever. And there's no blood.
Yeah, I love it. I love it.
That I thought you'd appreciate.
Go ahead.
There were lots of photos that were included in the obituary films for each of the children. And for Mady Rodriguez, there were a lot of really bad Photoshop jobs in the obituary. But there was one that I thought you'd really like. They had a picture of the family, their siblings. They're standing outside together in the open street. It's broad daylight. And the shadows of their heads are cast upon their chest. And the shadows of their legs are cast behind them. And I think that's only, that only occurs on the moon. So I thought you'd appreciate that.
Love it, love it, love it. By the way, I had an anonymous chiropractor look at Nashville. And he observed
about a 17-year-old boy.
As a person they blame it on is like this 26-year-old woman, which is why they had to create a transgender narrative. But the whole thing is a complete and total farce. If you go to my blog, jamesatfetzer.org, and just do a search on Nashville, I think it's the second story in Nashville that'll pop up. Check it out. It's really outrageous. And, of course, the Democrats want to push all their transgender rubbish. Here they got a heroine, right? Somebody, I mean, a transgender who actually can kill. Isn't that something that goes at the top of their pyramid of Democrat heroes today? It's disgusting. Brian.
Oh, there's not too much more I want to say about these things. I just want to point out, though, that there was an employee at the campus used a cell phone to open the district security app when the shooting started and select their red lockdown button to, you know, notify the police. The chief marketing officer for Raptor Technologies, the company that provides the security app, said that that's how it was notified, is because we had this expensive app on these phones, and this guy hit the warning tools exactly as he was supposed to. So congratulations to Raptor Technologies for having a security app that recorded the whole thing.
And we all want to get one of those, Brian. You can't be without it, right? You see how if a shooting occurs at your school, you can call the police immediately? What a farce.
Yeah. Unfortunately, Chief Arredondo showed up at the shooting with no police radio when he arrived. How could that possibly be?
With no police radio.
He doesn't have a radio, but he's there.
Well, see, he read the script.
The script? What script? You know, if I was going to pull something like this off, I could make sure that everything is modeled correctly in a 3D environment prior to trying to execute the plan. Make sure all the actors know exactly what they're going to do and how they're going to do it. But they didn't. They didn't even bother. They just relied completely on propaganda to drive this thing through. And, hey, they did it. Look at all the people that were fleeced out of their money thinking that they were saving the poor kids.
That's what's so frightening about this, is that you could pull off something that's so sloppy, and that they're not putting any effort into it whatsoever. I mean, it's actually insulting, but they're still getting away with it. That's very frightening. I have one question for both of you. When they stage these events, do you think that all of the actors that are involved, do you think they know that day that it's going live?
Yeah.
You think they all do?
I do.
Well, they've all signed non-disclosure agreements that they have no control and won't say anything about how it's used or publicized or promoted. So I think to that extent, they understand, at least.
Right, yeah. But they're given a certain amount of liberty. We saw this in the Buffalo shooting, and we saw this in the Orlando shooting. They're designated as people that are supposed to be giving media interviews because they're eyewitnesses to the scene. And they have a lot of liberty to fabricate their tales. And they really do go out of control with this, because it's like, hey, this is my moment in the light. This is my big acting gig. I'm going to go ahead and do this. Think of Christopher Hansen at the Pulse nightclub, and think of LaRon, or I can't remember his name, from the Buffalo shooting, the earliest and most reliable black witness who claimed that he had spent an hour talking with the shooter about white supremacy and Gatorade outside of the Buffalo supermarket. These people tell absolutely ridiculous, unbelievable tall tales.
And Brian, when he was interviewed, afterwards he said the second shot was 1.7 seconds after the first. So how did he know when the first was going to occur so he could start his top watch? Was he just staying red waiting? I mean, that sounds so absurd on his face. It's a joke.
And you can tell that the handlers are always nearby. I mean, I've identified the handlers in a lot of early and reliable videos that were there to make sure that the stories were not getting too out of control. But even under those circumstances, I mean, the biggest example is Christopher Hansen,
right.
Norman Cassiano, and others that told absolute. I mean, Norman Cassiano claimed to be shot in the gut 6 times in Orlando, and he was performing an interview for Fox News from the passenger seat of a Honda Civic less than 24 hours later. And he lifted up his shirt and showed some gauze taped to his back. He shot with a high-powered rifle by in the Orlando Pulse shooting nightclub 6 times, but here he is in the hey, it's okay. And he even said that the bullets missed all the important stuff.
What this shows, Alan, I think this is your question. American people are gullible saps. If they see it on television, don't believe anything. The most palpable nonsense, as you have been showing here, And Brian has demonstrated again and again, we can sell it. So they're going out of their way to be insulting because they know they're not going to be called out on it, that the media is all in on it. And they can say any damn thing they want and not be contradicted or held to account. I mean, it's embarrassing, but it's that bad.
Yeah, so the reason I ask about, you know, how much or to what degree the actors know in advance that it will go live. I mean, yeah, you mentioned that they sign NDAs, but the NDAs could be, you know, sort of a pro forma exercise for all of the events that they hold. And I just, you know, I kind of wonder if some of them get caught in something that they're not, they don't know how big it's going to become. They're not necessarily aware that, oh yeah, this is going to be a quote unquote real event. So.
No, I think some of them
are actually drills. They perform the same service in some that are actually drills and some of them that are taken live. It's
yeah,
the
exactly.
Same service that's performed. Yeah. So they get to get tested prior to getting rolled out.
I have a friend who used to do the makeup for these phony events, you know, like Las Vegas and others, where she'd, you know, put on the makeup to make it look like they'd been the victims of a shooting and all that stuff. So she finds it quite a lark. I got another friend who was a stuntman in Hollywood who really is floored by the amateurish way in which all this is carried out. But that's political theater in the USA today. That's how it's done.
Well, look, you've already got a lot of money for pulling this off. They have a very strong Masonic lodge locally. There's a lot of people involved in different things that made sure that the police would be willing to take this fall. Remember, there was all sorts of reports that the police had not done their job, that they were inside the school and didn't get it right. I believe Ledesma wasn't Ledesma at all. I believe he was some sort of crisis actor sent in there in a rental car to bring credibility, saying that he had Facebook Live. But remember, this man had never barely used Facebook, or this account had barely been used, but he has the presence of mind to show up in his rental car while his kids are supposedly being shot up inside of a school, and he goes live for over an hour without putting the camera down, nor does he show himself in any of the camera, walking around the school narrating the talking points, even mentioning Sandy Hook and other school shootings. It's just too much for me to believe that this is the only guy that showed up with the camera to do this. And it makes all the sense in the world to me that he had a very specific purpose for being there, and that was to bring credibility to the event. Unfortunately, all the earliest and most reliable evidence that originates from these scenes is absolutely damning to official narratives. And of course, my favorite one among this one is the fact that there is an absolute lack of presence of sirens and EMS vehicles to take all these dead kids out of the school or semi-dead kids. And you've got airlifts to local hospitals, all sorts of things taking place that just simply didn't exist inside the video.
Brian, I don't know if you ran into this, but one of the most absurd stories that I heard or details was that they actually claimed that when they loaded the kids onto the bus, they stopped at the local civic center first. And that was actually in a story that they released like a year later. I think it was AJ Martinez, if you look at his media account. And there's just so many ridiculous stories that they have. The idea that you would have these kids, some of whom were supposed to be injured, but oh, we're just going to stop by the Civic Center to see if anyone was shot there as well. You know, it just doesn't make sense. I mean, first of all, it doesn't make sense loading the kids onto a bus when you have, you know, if let's suppose you give them. Let's suppose you give them that there was no ambulance there. Couldn't you have used like a police vehicle to take an injured child rather than a big bus loading a bus up full of children to get them all to the hospital? I mean, yeah, so very little of this makes sense at all.
Yeah, as for the kids, first of all, let me be very clear. I don't believe that school was actually active. Now, I don't have a lot to support that, but it didn't appear right to me that the neighborhood kids were saying, yeah, well, school was out that day. I mean, I spent a lot of time down there walking around, and some of them were like, no, I wasn't at school. School was out that day. other people were clearly there to support and fabricate the story for the arriving reporters. So it was very confusing to me, but whatever happened that day, the story that, you know, all the classrooms were playing the same Lilo and Stitch and movies, and all these teachers were inside these rooms and all these kids had to be evacuated. Remember that they showed this massive presence of cops within the hallway prior to them breaching the room to take out the shooter. You mean to tell me that they couldn't evacuate those kids after an hour? They had to keep them all locked down in the rooms according to the rules, why supposedly the parents waited outside. I think just about everybody got the scene was in on it. And then there was that red herring related to people taking their kids out of the bus. That was all captured in Ledesma. How the fights breaking out.
Alan Burke. Alan, you're wonderful. Just a lot to have you here. Brian, thank you for joining everyone out there.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
That's right here, Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
We did not engage in conflict that was out of line with our mission.
Is it disloyal? Is it sedition? Is it treason to oppose the hands of tyranny? Never!
I will never send troops anywhere on a mission of that kind without telling them that if somebody shoots at them, they can darn well shoot back.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty! Oh, give me!
A dark cloud is finally lifting across the world as U.S. military intelligence and their